The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ARFCON do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ARFCON, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ARFCON, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begins.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love to stick in battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCON starts now.
Hello, everybody out there in ARFCON land. This is John Gold, and you're listening to Radio Free ARFCON. Well, we've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to start off today with Joe DeBurgley, our NRA board member. We've got Chris Fry coming in from MBTS training. We've got a couple of get-to-knows for you this week instead of just the one. We're gonna debut our game show, Stump the Deej. And our first contestant this week will be Wheelchair Man. Hopefully he's got some good questions for the Deej. We've also got Phil Schreier from the National Firearms Museum. We've got Micah Clark from Camp Patriot. And then we're going to go live with Going Galt this week. Instead of a pre-recorded segment, we're going to go live with Matt Hoffman. So let's get this show started off right with Joe DeBurgley. Joe, are you there?
I'm here, John. How are you this week?
Doing great. How was your week?
Fantastic, thank you. Sounds like you got a great show.
We got a good show lined up today. I wanted to start off with you because there are a lot of right to keep and bear arms issues in the news lately, and you're our expert on that, so I wanted to go over some of them. The first thing I wanted to go over was the issue with the Caesar Rodney Institute. Can you kind of tell our listeners what's going on with that?
Yeah, definitely, John. A couple weeks back, we framed it out. The issue being is this. There was a five-month investigation by the Caesar Rodney Institute in Delaware that revealed that all the four state public housing authorities banned their residents from owning firearms, contrary to, obviously, the Delaware Constitution and the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, if you violate this gun ban, you can be evicted out of your house. So for many families, an eviction from public housing will leave them nowhere to go but the streets. We're talking about the people who are underprivileged and what have you.
Right.
Well, the NRA, through its ILA, its Institute for Legislative Action, led by our former president, John Sigler, and a few other board members, got together with the Institute and looked into it, did an investigation, and basically said, you can't do that. Chris Cox came on board and said, that's it, help's on the way. We started the process for lawsuits, and I'm proud to announce that one out of the four so far, the Newark Housing Project, basically came out and said, we were wrong. It's not going to happen. The regulation was rescinded. And just as long as the people can lawfully possess the firearm, they can stay in their residences. So we got one down, three more to go, but this is how the NRA works for you.
So what's going to happen then? Is it going to be, it's going to have to go to the courts here for the other three, or do you think the other three will see the error of their ways and just say, hey, you know, we were wrong?
We built a strong case, John. We've got a lot of good information. We've talked to a lot of residents. Obviously, this banning or this way to regulate around a person's right to keep and bear arms is going to be rescinded. It's just a matter of getting down to some good negotiation now and seeing what we're going to do. So I think we're going to have some very positive news in the next couple of days.
Okay, that sounds good. For anybody who wants to know, check out the website www.nraila.org. It's got a wealth of right to keep and bear arms news there. They update it daily. It always talks about everything the NRA is doing for us, gun owners, to preserve our right to keep and bear arms. Another issue I wanted to talk to you about, it's getting a lot of press, is this UN arms trade treaty that people are worried that this treaty is going to get passed and then the UN blue helmets are going to be coming in and confiscating everybody's guns.
This is true, John. This seems to rear its ugly head every 5 or 6 years. The NRA is listed as a non-governmental organization at the UN. We've got some great people there. Taking point on our initiative this year is no other than former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton. We've had Congressman Bob Barr. I think he's going to be working on it as well, but he's been the lead in years past. We get some very good people working on this. Our status as an NGO allows us to sit there and do basically what we do on the national side with a registered lobbyist, what have you, in our nation's capital of Washington. We can go there and educate the member countries as to why this isn't something that's going to be good for the United States of America to sign on to or become party of. The one thing that we always have going, and I want to emphasize this to the listening audience, is that Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives, nor our president, can sign on to any type of treaty with a foreign entity if it violates our Constitution.
Okay.
We've got the Second Amendment to the Constitution, so all this basically is null and void, but we always like to sit there and become party to what we can and what we cannot do. We've been there. We've deadlocked the Small Arms Conference on many occasions by basically education. So we're on the forefront of making sure that none of these issues that people tend to get on the threads and talk about are going to be instituted here in the United States of America. That's not to say that there's other concerns out there and other countries out there who want to have this treaty and want to become a party to it and sign the accord. We have high hopes that that's not going to happen for the United States of America because it would be a clear violation of our Constitution.
So if this were somehow passed or shoved through by this administration and Congress, what would be the ramifications of it?
Well, it's unconstitutional. It would be a tremendous amount of lawsuits and what have you, and we'd be passing laws, and it would be something that would go down to the Security Council of the United Nations and be in negotiations. Because we can't. Part of our Constitution also states we cannot sign onto a treaty that violates our own Constitution. So that's one of our things going into these talks all the time, where people raises the specter of they're going to come in the United States and pass their laws. It's not going to happen. It can't happen. Our government cannot be party to it. So we're there. We're going to be, there'll be informational updates in the next couple of weeks coming out about what's going on, what's transpiring. But we have one of the best people on the case, and former Ambassador John Bolton. The NRA ILA is there, and we'll be reporting it in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. So the people can loosen up tinfoil hats a little bit and don't have to worry about the blue helmets coming into their neighborhood this week anyway, right?
Anytime soon, yes, sir.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about McDonald versus Chicago. It's the follow-up case from Heller versus D.C., and it will have significant impact on people's right to keep and bear arms in places where they are restricted in some cities now.
Well, most definitely. If most people realize that upcoming March 2nd is when they're going to start deliberating, the Supreme Court's going to take on McDonald versus Chicago, City of Chicago, which is basically the incorporation of the Second Amendment. Now, in Heller, it was pertaining to the federal enclave of the District of Columbia. In Chicago versus McDonald versus the City of Chicago, is going to talk about the incorporation of our Second Amendment. And the argument's going to be there is basically we had some announcements from the NRA this past week and a half, that the Supreme Court granted the NRA the opportunity to argue. And we're going to have former U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement representing the NRA's portion of the argument. And what we're going to be doing now is making claim that the Second Amendment applies to states under the 14th Amendment, the due process. So there's two ways we're going here. Alan Gura, who's going to be the other attorney, is going to basically look at it through the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and we're going to be looking at the Due Process Clause.
Okay.
The solitary goal that we have. I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
Some of the people on the website have been a little bit critical about the NRA stepping in, thinking that they are stepping on Alan Gura's toes in this matter. Do you want to kind of go over exactly what the situation is with that?
Well, I can't comment as to what the legal strategy is going to be or what Mr. Gura and the relationship with the NRA. What goes on is that we've got, and we've become encumbered and we've been joined in the fight for our rights. Their legal strategy is going to be one of Mr. Gura is going to be the lead attorney. Mr. Clement's going to be somebody who comes in and talks about our issue that was granted by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
To talk about what I want to do is keep it on a positive note because we want to go forward and we want to win this.
Sure.
Like anything
that's
else,
the
there's a whole bunch of different
thing.
Strategies involved. Right. They're going to be coordinating their efforts. We're going to go forward. And there's always enough time and enough room and enough praise to go around once we become victorious. So let's
sure.
just focus on the main goal of getting this through the court, getting an affirmative decision, and go forward from there. Personalities aside, we can do a lot of good things.
And for those that have the trepidation about it, I just want to tell them that I think the best thing for us and our right to keep and bear arms is to get as many competent parties involved arguing for us, arguing for the side of the gun owner. The more competent attorneys we have arguing for us, the better the chances are for us to win these cases.
Oh, most certainly. And that's the way we look at it. We try to take a team approach going forward. Both these guys and everybody else in all these fights that we take on are very, very capable and competent. They're at the very top of their game, and they have the best interest of the entire gun community.
Okay, hey, we have a caller calling in for you, Joe. We have Templar223 online. Templar, you're on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Hey, welcome, Joe. Good job on the Delaware issue and the public housing. Big thank you for what the NRA is doing there for the public housing residents. And also, I was calling today to thank you for donating Nick Randstad's ghillie suit to the NRA's National Firearms Museum. I thought that was a very fitting and a very noble thing to do with that incredible prize that you won a while back. And I want to congratulate and salute you for that, and thank you for all the good work you're doing with the NRA and representing ARFCOM, so to speak, at the NRA. And that's all I've got. Thanks again, Joe, and you guys have a good night.
Thanks,
Tom. That was a great call. Thank you so much. It was an honor to donate that ghillie suit. We'll have some announcements on ARFCOM coming up about when we finally make it a presentation and get Nick down there with the family and people from Randstad Militia.
For those that don't know, we had Nick Randstad on 2 weeks ago talking about his infamous sniper shot, the longest sniper shot in U.S. Army history. And the actual ghillie suit he was wearing during that shot was given away in a raffle on AR15.com by the Randstad Militia. And you won the raffle, right, Joe?
Yes, sir.
And instead of saying, oh, wow, I have this ghillie suit and I'm going to put it up in my den and it's just going to be a great prop for my house and I'm going to be able to tell stories to my buddies when they come over, you donated this on your own accord to the National Firearms Museum. And for everybody out there that doesn't know, the National Firearms Museum is a great, great organization. We're actually going to have Phil Schreier on a little later. He's going to talk about some of the pieces they've got in the National Firearms Museum. And I also would like to thank you. That was pretty generous of you. It really was. There's a lot of people out there that probably wouldn't have done that.
Well, it's a great cause. We try to do our part for all our serving members overseas, and Nick and his family have become very close friends of mine, and it's in a place of honor, and that's where it should be. That's where our fellow Americans can go, take a look at the suit that this warrior was wearing, and for generations to come, they can sit there and say, okay, this is what transpires. This is who's fighting for our freedom. So it was an honor to do so.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the issue in Alabama right now that a lot of people probably aren't aware of. Can you go ahead and talk about that?
Well, there seems to be a lot of things going on in the states. In Alabama, the good friends down, Roll Tide. In Bama, there was some legislation that was dropped in their Senate. It was sponsored by Representative Jeremy Oden. And this has been going on for the last couple of years. And in essence, what it does is allow the possession of shortened barreled firearms, both rifles and shotguns.
Uh-huh.
This would be something where right now, they consider that if you're carrying a short-barreled rifle, it's akin to a sawed-off shotgun, and it's illegal, allowing police officers to pull you over for a little bit more than probable cause, a little less than that, actually. So it's
uh-huh.
something where they have been fighting down in Alabama the last couple of years to codify their laws to allow shortened-barreled weapons to be allowed, and you'll be in compliance with the law. It's there. It's been something that's been hotly contended. It passed by an overwhelming vote. I think it was 82-3, if I'm not mistaken.
Uh-huh.
And it was something where it's much needed. It's common sense legislation. Hopefully we're pushing it. Our state liaison from the NRA, ILA, is down there and working each day to make sure that becomes signed into law. We're very positive that it maybe. We can never say we're 100% certain, but it's something where we're going to allow the shortened barrels to be possessed and utilized down in the great state of Alabama.
Just another good example of the NRA working for gun owners' rights. Now, I have a couple issues I want to talk about. We've got callers on the line for you, and so this show is all about the listeners and the members of AR15.com, the visitors of AR15.com, so let's go right to them. Scrap 5000's on line B1. You're on Radio Free ARFCOM, Scrap.
Hi, Joe. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Hi,
Scrap. Lifetime member in the NRA. God bless
you
guys.
Thank you for support. And God bless you.
God bless you. Thank you. I actually have two questions, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, sir.
One is about the Interstate Commerce Clause. I get the journal, obviously, and I read that the NRA doesn't believe that it has much of a chance, or you don't want to back them. The states that are fighting this, I know that goes back to the 1800s with the wheat and all that, and the chances
right.
don't look all that good, a lot of people say. I was wondering if the NRA has more and more states are actually taking on legislation like this and putting teeth to it and threatening to actually charge the federal agents with felonies. Has the NRA maybe changed its stance about that? That's number one. And number two, with the whole concealed carry reciprocity throughout the whole nation, I was wondering now that we have a Republican senator in Massachusetts, do you think that we're closer now, and with the elections coming up in November, do you think we have a much better chance of getting that passed?
Let me take your second question first. I believe that we fell too short in the democratically held Senate overall. Unfortunately, at that time, if two of the Republicans who voted in the negative voted for our way, we would have passed. I'm out of New York, so both my senators, Gillibrand and Schumer, obviously voted no for it. I think we're one step closer with Scott taking over in Massachusetts. Which is, he's on our side, he's a pro-gun guy, military man, good person. I think we're going to get there, it's just a matter of bringing it back up for a vote. We did a lot of hard work to get it there, it was a difficult decision to make, to push it forward. We did it, we're behind it 1,000%. I think you're going to see that again, hopefully when they impanel the next Congress after the 2010 midterms. With the Interstate Clause and the Freedom Firearms Act and what have you, we're not opposed to it. We're monitoring it. We're looking to see where it goes. It's something where it's going to be a state-by-state type of thing. I think there's a movement out there that we're going to look at it and see where we best can lay the assets that we have. But it's just going to be a state-by-state battle. It's going to be interesting to see where we go with this and what we do. But I think that's going to take a few more years to get through the system. I think there's a lot of legal challenges ahead once that does pass.
Are you still there, Scrap?
Yeah, I'm still here. That was a great answer. I appreciate that. Actually,
okay.
I did notice, I'd read in Gun Owners of America, that there was some rumors that some of the senators had actually changed their votes to yes when it was apparent that, or obvious that they weren't going to reach the 60 members. I was wondering if NRA has any views on that or any confirmation about that.
Oh, most definitely. That happens on basically any vote that's brought to the floor. They sit there and see, especially when there's these major issues, Second Amendment-type issues, where, let's just say, a typical or somebody who counts to be a Second Amendment supporter, he or she will get information from the whip or the leader, and they make it released to join or vote yes when their party is saying no, or vote no when the party is saying yes, just for political cover, basically. That did happen. A couple senators' names escape me right now, so I don't want to get you wrong information. But that happens basically, Scrap, at every vote. So there's a couple people looking to change their vote one or two times.
It always ends up being some political wrangling no matter what. You can't get away from it.
That's exactly what happens. They're sitting there looking at it. If it's something they feel they needed to vote, he would vote no, not. I believe the one case they cited was that there was one where he came out in negative first and then saw that they had enough no votes, so he didn't change it to a yes. So,
hey,
that happens, unfortunately.
Do you have time for one more call, Joe? And we'll talk about some of the issues I want to talk about next week. Okay. Shizzle Ma from Maine. He's on line B2. You're on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Hey, greetings, guys. I got a question for you, Joe. With recent ruling at the federal level to repeal or displace the ban on guns in national parks,
right.
Up here in Maine, we've got a bill that's going to put some of those parks back under a no-guns policy. And I'm curious how this is being handled in other states, or if you've got any good words of advice.
Well, as you may or may not know, February 22nd is when the new guns in the parks rule takes effect, the federal rule. And you'll be able to carry in a federal protective reservation. Now, as you correctly stated, there's various states are sitting there and passing laws saying that you can't. So there is going to be, here's again, it's always a treasure trove for a lot of attorneys, going to be some lawsuits out there. So we'll see what transpires. The big test is going to come is if you're on a federal reservation in a state that passes anti-legislation. And right now, the major federal reservations or parks are basically gun-friendly states. But, like you mentioned in Maine, they're looking to pass a few things that may run contrary to the federal law. So we're monitoring that. We're looking at it, and obviously we'll challenge it from every avenue.
Now, what would be contrary to federal law, as you say, would give us an opportunity?
No. If there's a state law that's passed saying you cannot carry into a state park that's adjoined to a federal property or what have you, and they run contrary, then there'll be a lawsuit or there'll be some type of legal action. If it's a federal enclave that's entirely in a state that... So February 22nd going with that, you can carry. But there may be some issues that, look, anything that passes, there's always one or two wrinkles that need to be ironed out, and we'll cross that. So we pushed it forward. We had a real good legislative push to get it going. Great victory a couple months back. So we'll see how this whole thing shakes down. But I think we're very positive going forward as to the National Park Service and the rule. Because they long prohibited Americans from carrying. So we went forward. Now, specifically to Maine, you stated you have some type of legislation that's out there that may be challenging what's going on?
Yeah, we do, and the bill is kind of was very creatively written. It's basically going to be a reinstatement of the federal legislation that's set to expire, but it looks like it's only going to apply to one particular location, one Acadia National Park in Maine, and it's explicitly not going to apply to the Appalachian Trail, to... any of the other federal lands that are now going to be, they're going to fall under the typical state rules.
I'll have to research a little bit more. Cause I don't want to give you the wrong information. But if you give me 1737, we'll be happy to talk about it.
Okay, why don't we bring that up next week? We'll talk a little bit about that, because that is interesting. Okay, let's squeeze in one more call here. We've got Maine LWRC. You're on with Joe DeBurgley on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Yeah, hello. Hi, Joe. How are you doing today?
Very good.
Hey, can you turn down your speakers in the background,
please? I wanted to ask you, please. Hello?
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir. No, I just wanted to ask you. I heard one of the other callers mention about Gun Owners of America. I was just wondering what your opinion is about Gun Owners of America as far as their way of lobbying their agenda as opposed to the NRA, and if there's been any kind of correlation for the your good of the whole right to keep and bear arms issues. Basically, you know, what kind of cooperation, if and or any, and the differences between you two guys' approach towards the whole lobbying issue there in Washington?
Well, they're both independent organizations, as I'm sure you know. I'm a life member of both, as well as probably about 25 other Second Amendment advocacy organizations. Do we take different approaches on things? We surely do. Do we work cooperatively on a variety of issues? We do. To identify certain issues or strategies or what have you, it's difficult for me because I'm not on staff or I'm not a board member of GOA. Perhaps we can get somebody on from them. I think they do a fine job on what they do. Like I said, I'm a life member of it, but I can't really give you specifics as to how we work together or not. Basically, the entire pro-Second Amendment community comes together on a variety of issues, and sometimes they oppose each other on others. It's a matter of what fights they think we have to do and we have to go. There's always a difference of opinion in any large group of people you get together. So
Right. No, I mean, I can understand that completely. You know, you have a lot of people, even though it's for the greater cause of the right to keep and bear arms, everybody's going to have their different opinions, their different agendas, and especially their different ways of doing things. I just, myself personally, I mean, having been a member of both the NRA and Gun Owners of America, now I'm just an NRA member and a life member at that, I just sometimes have found that almost the Gun Owners of America organization, that their way of doing things, it almost seems to almost, I don't know if I want to say contradict the NRA, or sometimes even seems like the two agendas are not as paralleling as they should be.
Like I said, I'm a life member of the two, and I support them. But they're different organizations. I think they're different for a variety of reasons. I would never personally say that this organization is better than the other organization or what have you, because like I wouldn't be a life member of them if I didn't. I think overall, as long as we make sure that our Second Amendment rights are ensured, we're going forward, I think that's the best thing. That's the best goal to have, or the mission to have. When we start the infighting and we allow the Brady organizations or Brady-type organizations or the Bloombergs of the world to gain distance on us, that's not what we should be doing. We should be going forward. We may come from different tribes, but we should be going for the end goal together. And that's the way I think a lot of times when we get together under the umbrella, we may not like the way it looks, it's like making sausage, but the end result's pretty good sometimes.
Amen to that, Joe. All I can say is, what's the old saying? We'll either hang together or hang separately, right?
Most definitely. Most definitely. Thanks for your support of the NRA, too. I appreciate that.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And I just want to say that as far as Old Painless, we need to see more Box of Truth out there. Old Painless is a great guy, and I absolutely love his posts. He's the best.
Old Painless, man, we've got a Box of Truth on coming up later in the show today for you guys, too. Hey, Joe, I want to thank you for your time. We ran a little bit long here, but I really appreciate you and all the work you do. I want everyone to know that Joe he's kind of the ARFCOM liaison to the NRA. The AR15.com had a lot to do with helping him get in, and he's done a lot to help us at AR15.com. I want to thank him for that. He's in the trenches every day dealing with these issues and fighting for our right to keep and bear arms. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thanks, John. Have a great show.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week. Okay, coming up here in just a minute, we'll have Chris Fry from MBTS Training. But I wanted to talk a little bit. There was an issue earlier this week on AR15.com that many of us are aware of, and many gun owners are aware of, about a detective in East Palo Alto, California, Detective Rod Tuason, who made some comments that probably were not the smartest thing he could have done on someone else's Facebook page. There is now a Facebook group up called America's Gun Owners Say Fire Detective Rod Tuason. If you'd like to be a part of that group, log on to your Facebook account and search for America's Gun Owners Say Fire Detective Rod Tuason. It looks like they have 4,000 members already for that group. And for those that don't know, Detective Tuason was posting on one of his friend's Facebook accounts, and he posted a couple of things that, I'll quote what he said. He was referring to the open carry movement in California, where in order to carry a firearm openly, open carry, not concealed, it has to be unloaded, but it is lawful to do so in the state of California as long as the weapon is not loaded. He said, quote, "Ha ha, we had one guy try to do it last week, try to do it. He got proned out and reminded where he was and that turds will jack him for his gun in a heartbeat." And then a few comments later down the page, he said, quote, "Sounds like you had someone practicing their Second Amendment rights last night. Should have pulled out the AR and prone them out. And if one of them makes a furtive movement, 2 weeks off." Now, for those that don't know, 2 weeks off refers to usually the suspension that an officer will get. They usually get a paid suspension after any shooting incident. So he was basically inferring that if someone is rightfully executing, exhibiting their Second Amendment rights, that he wants to prone them out, lay you down on the ground at the point of an AR-15 behind his badge, and then shoot you and say you made a furtive movement. If you're not outraged by that, then you're not a real gun owner. So go check out the Facebook group, America's Gun Owners Say, Fire Detective Rod Tuason, T-U-A-S-O-N. Check that out on Facebook. While you're at it, add Radio Free ARFCOM as one of your friends on Facebook. Do a search for Radio Free ARFCOM. We've got a Facebook presence now, and we're trying to get as many friends as we can. So send us a friend request, and we'll get you accepted as soon as possible. Right now, we're going to go straight to Chris Fry from MDTS Training. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, how are you, John?
Doing outstanding. Thanks for being on the show with us today.
Not a problem.
We haven't had any trainers on yet, and I wanted you to come on and be our first trainer because you have a unique background when it comes to training. You kind of approach it with a little different style than most, and your training is top-notch. I've gone to your website. For those who want to know, it's mdtstraining.com. Talk a little bit about your background and how you got started in firearms and what drew you to be a trainer and how did you accomplish that?
Well, I've been studying martial arts since I was a young man, since I was about 13 years old. And throughout my teens and early 20s through college and stuff, I continued to train different martial arts, and I was assaulted after I was working in a bar in my hometown as a bouncer, and I got assaulted pretty bad by a couple guys after work one night and realized that the martial arts were great. I learned a lot of great things and developed a lot of good attributes, but unfortunately I was ill-prepared for what was really out there. And
what happened?
So
these guys just laid an ambush for you or something?
Kinda. Yeah. What happened was I turned away a couple of guys from the bar. One of them was underage, and they didn't like that, and they waited for me. And one of them grabbed me, the other one sucker punched me, and then they took the boots to me. So.
Oh wow.
It wasn't very fun, and like I said, it was a real ego buster, because you know you're a young man and young, dumb, and how's the rest of that saying go? You know, and you
full of vinegar.
You think you're invincible. You know, you got a black belt, and you think that you're Bruce Lee. And I soon realized that I wasn't. And so, instead of just giving up, I loved the martial arts, and I loved the whole personal protection, you know, study of that kind of material. And so I, you know, pushed on and started studying other things and expanded my interests into some reality-based martial arts and JKD at the time. You know, that's was out there. It was JKD and the Filipino martial arts, and a lot of spent 20 years in the Filipino martial arts studying edged impact weapons. And around the early 90s, I realized that, you know, I'd covered a lot of the different ranges of combat. I had a decent grounding in stand-up fighting and grappling and clinch work and the tools, weapon works and knife and impact weapon work. But I realized that, you know, there's one area that I had yet to really seriously pursue, and that was, you know, that was the firearms aspect of it. And I've been shooting since I was a little boy. I grew up, you know, in an area where, you know, we had 35 acres, and my two older brothers, my father, you know, we shot every week out in our backyard, from everything from, you know, 22s to, you know, shotguns and, you know, the hunting rifles and stuff. We didn't, we never had an AR or anything like that back when I was a kid. So I, through the early 90s, I went around and really put a lot of effort into going to different training classes. And I started off with NRA classes and got certified as an NRA instructor. And then from there, expanded out into the tactical arena and did some training with a bunch of different trainers from across the United States. And in, I guess, 2003 or something like that, I started teaching the NRA classes in 99 and in 2000. And then in 2002 or 2003, I met some guys, and we started shooting together, and we had a little group going. And guys asked me to, you know, kind of like do a workshop, you know, because I guess I had a knack for teaching the material, and I'd done some training with people they hadn't, and they'd done some training with people I hadn't, so we would get together and exchange material and ideas. And, you know, ARFCOMers, they're guys from AR15.com, and eventually that workshop grew and people were calling me and saying, geez, you know, can you do this class or can you do a class on that? And, you know, not only did they want gun stuff, but they wanted the knife stuff. They wanted some empty hand training. And I was lucky enough to meet the Avillas, and they came and did some training with me and great people. And from there, it just blossomed. You know, I tell people all the time I'm kind of a reluctant teacher because I'm more of a student. I really like training. I'm a training junkie, and you know, I teach to fund my habit. You know, it's my crack. You know, so that's what I do.
Sure. So just for everybody out there, I want people to understand that you don't have to be an ex-Green Beret, an ex-Special Forces Commando to give good quality training. And a lot of times, you'll get ex-SWAT team guys or ex-military guys, and they're not to say they're bad trainers at all. What I'm saying is that sometimes they come with their own angle or their own slant based on their experiences. You know, they come onto a scene, a law enforcement SWAT team comes onto a scene, they've got total control of the situation. They've got the force of the badge behind them. They've got a certain amount of respect and authority that comes just by being who they are, the department they're with, or, you know, you roll up in a Humvee or two or three Humvees and you'd pop out a special forces team. There's a certain amount of authority with that. But your training is unique in that you're a civilian. You come from a civilian background. So all your training is based from that standpoint, from the standpoint of, hey, I'm just a regular Joe from the street. And this is kind of what situations we have to deal with as a regular Joe. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I run everything that I see through a filter. You know, I mean, I've done training with military guys. I've done training with a lot of law enforcement, current and ex law enforcement guys, and it's great training. Any training is good training in my eyes. You know, I mean, I always learn something, but I run it through a filter for my own personal application and for the dissemination to people that train with me. Because I'm a citizen, and not former law enforcement or former, you know, Delta operator or whatever, and my resume doesn't reflect that, you know, people automatically think, well, what's this guy got to offer? And you know what? I understand that. You know, that's a legitimate question to ask. But what I do offer people is the fact that, you know, I've been involved in violence and, you know, I've never been in a gunfight, but I've come close to a lot of other very bad things. And as a citizen, I know what I need to work for me. And you know, like for example, you know, partner tactics and stuff. I mean, that's a great thing to have. And for a citizen, everything that I've learned about partner tactics and team tactics, I apply to family tactics. You know, what is my spouse going to do while I'm, you know, trying to handle the situation? I mean, and I run it through that kind of filter. So I get a lot of real good feedback from citizens that say that have been to other training, and the training they've been to is very military or law enforcement oriented, as far as the gear that the guys got, and, you know, they're all geared up and kitted out and everything, and that's great. And again, I'm not downplaying any of that. I've done it. I love it. You know, I do it in a second. If somebody gives me a class, I'm there, you know. But as a citizen, you know, I'm not going to jump out of bed and have, you know, a chest rig on. I'm going to have my boxer shorts on and a pair of flip-flops, you know. So what can I do in that context, and what am I capable of, and how will that affect my tactics?
Sure.
And maybe that's nothing new. Maybe the way I'm looking at it is nothing new, and I don't claim that it is. I'm just saying that's how I try to promote my material to other people and to students.
Sure. I like your all-encompassing view of training. You've got to have the hand-to-hand. You've got to have some of the hand-to-hand weapons training. You've got to have the firearms, the pistol, and the carbine training. It's all-encompassing, and I really like that approach. Now, for people who think that they can't get training because they've gone to some of these bigger training websites and seen how expensive it is to train. I mean, some of these places, some of the money, you could almost buy a new gun for the price of some of the training you can get. Your courses are very, very reasonably priced.
Yeah, well, it's like I said before, John, I'm a junkie, you know, and I've gone to a lot of training with a bunch of different people, and there's been some classes that I've gone to, and I've spent, and I tell this to my buddies and people that come to my classes all the time, I've gone to training where I've spent a lot of money. Just like you just said, I've spent enough money to where I could have turned around and either bought an AR or had a damn good down payment on it, you know, and I've walked away from that training course, and again, I learned something, so was it worth it? Yes. But would I have rather spent that money on something else, or would it have been wiser of me to spend that money on something else? Probably so. And then I've been to other classes where I haven't spent nearly as much, and the whole class was directly applicable to my life and as a citizen, and I learned, you know, I feel like I learned 10 times more, and it was half the cost. So my whole perspective on what I try to promote and provide to other people is that, you know, I have a day job. I mean, I run my company. It's a part-time thing, and I really don't want it to be full-time because of certain reasons, but, you know, I have a day job, so I pay my bills with that money, you know, and so I do this because I love doing it, and because of that, I can offer people a carving class for, you know, a quarter of what, you know, some other people are offering the carving classes. Plus, you know, the other thing comes back to the whole, you know, not to downplay myself or anything, but, you know, the one thing I don't have to back up my resume is, you know, I've never been, you know, in the sandbox. I wasn't in the Hollywood, you know, shooting or anything like that. So, I don't feel it's right for me to go around charging people $400 for a class. You know, I'd feel that was, I think that there is a certain element of, experience that is portrayed and conveyed to a student from guys who have that kind of experience, if they're good communicators.
Sure.
And that's, you know, that's what your teaching is all about. You know, it's are you a good communicator, and do you know your material? And I think what's important is, can you demonstrate that? Can you, you know, there's a lot of guys that are out there that can teach. There's a lot of guys out there that can do it. There's, you know, very few guys, in my experience, that can get out there and they can teach it, they can do it, and on request, and when a student challenges them, they can get up and shoot right next to the student. And that's one thing that, you know, I try to do. I demonstrate all my own drills. I get up there and, you know, I'm not just one of these guys that tells people what to do, you know, because I feel, because that's training for me. When I teach, that's a chance for me to pull the trigger, you know, or, you know, throw a punch or get on the mats and roll around with a dude. You know, that's a chance for me to get in some reps and getting my own training.
So you're based in upstate New York, is that correct? But you've trained in a whole lot of different states.
Yeah. I'm in Utica, which is in between Albany, New York, and Syracuse, New York. But I've provided training in Nevada, Florida, Tennessee, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey. I do a lot of training down in Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, of course, and I don't know, Canada. I presented at a conference up in Canada.
I'm looking at your schedule just for the year. You've got scheduled out, looks like you've got events scheduled all the way till November. New Hampshire, I'm reading Virginia, New Jersey, New York, several places in New York, a few places in New Jersey. So if you live in the Northeast section of the country and you want to get some training from Chris, check out his website at mdtstraining.com. And Chris has actually agreed to give away a few $25 training gift certificates today to our callers, to a few of our callers, just to come in. And that $25 will almost pay for your ammunition for like a handgun training class, won't it?
Yeah. The round count for most of our one-day classes is about 400 to 500 rounds. So it'll help out, you know, let's put it that way. But, you know, again, the price of my classes locally is cheaper than if I'm, like, driving to New Jersey, because if I got to drive 4 hours in the car, then, you know, I charge a little bit more money. But, you know, $25 for one of my classes is almost a quarter of the price of the class.
Yeah, it's a significant amount. You guys really need to check out his prices. They are amazing. You want some quality training and you always thought you couldn't afford it, this is the guy to go to. We've got some callers waiting, so I'm not going to keep these callers waiting anymore. Artifacts from Ohio. He's on line B1. Artifacts, you're on Radio Free ARFCOM with Chris Fry.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Actually, it's funny. What I was calling about is something you were just discussing, and that was being a trainer without having a specific law enforcement or military background. Like yourself, I just recently became a NRA certified instructor, and I've taken courses around the country, Thunder Ranch, Blackwater, TDI, and so forth. But as an instructor, I've found exactly what you were saying, that people think unless you've seen the elephant, you don't know how to be an effective trainer. And I've got to say, you know, I think that you're dead on, that there are people who maybe have done it, but can't communicate it, whereas you don't necessarily have to have done it to be able to communicate what to do. And sure, you might not have a lot of that same legitimacy or star factor that a someone who's an ex Delta Ranger SEAL space shuttle door gunner kind of person has, but it doesn't mean you're not an effective trainer. And so actually, you had kind of already answered the question a little bit, but I wanted to just call in and compliment you on your success, and thank you for what you do.
Hey man, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. It's good to hear. It's good to hear that. You know, because it's, you know, I always wonder when I say that. You know, especially on an open forum like this. You know, I always wonder what guys are thinking. You know, and I'm sure there's guys out there that are thinking, no, that's bullshit. You know, these guys, he's teaching people how to use a gun. You know, he better have shot somebody. And I, you know, I don't know. I guess I equate that to look at, you know, boxing coaches or other fighting forums. You know, a lot of the guys that teach don't, they've never been in a fight in their life. And in some respects, that's a good thing. In some respects, that's not a good thing. And ultimately, for me, it comes down to, I can learn from anybody. It's just a matter of how good that person can communicate the message to me, you know?
Artifact.
Yep. So, thanks a lot.
Thank you. We give you a $25 gift certificate for you to go get some training from Chris.
Awesome.
Okay. Why won't you send me an IM, send it to Radio Free ARFCOM, at the AR-15 boards. You know how to send me an IM, right?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, you send me an IM, and I'll make sure you get that gift certificate, okay? You make sure you use it, though.
All right, will do. Hey, thanks a lot.
Okay, take care.
Take care.
We've got another caller for you, Wade from New York. He's on line B2. Wade, you're on Radio Free ARFCOM with Chris Fry.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Wade.
How you doing?
Good. What's going on, bud?
I wanted to relate a story that to these guys. I've trained with you for several years now, and I wanted to relate a story that you haven't even been told. Several years ago, when I was just dating my wife, I did something foolish. I stopped in a parking lot to gather some directions and stuff together. While I was in Syracuse, and one of the things that you teach is to always be aware of your surroundings, and even though I put myself in a situation where I probably shouldn't have been, my feelers went up, something was wrong, and I see a guy hiding behind one of these 4x8 signs that you see on the road in front of a business of some sort, and basically sneaking up on me. Nothing came of it because I was aware of it, but half of the battle is not getting into a fight in the first place, and this is something that I've picked up through your training, and I just wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, well, you're welcome. I mean, you knew all that stuff beforehand anyway. You know, you're just being nice right now, Wade.
No, I'm not being nice. I don't go through life with blinders on, but still, part of your training that you stress, you know, is if you can avoid getting into an altercation to try not to, and especially in the hand-to-hand stuff that we've done over the years, but I just wanted to thank you, Chris, and I'm really stoked to be able to train with you, and hope to do it sometime in the near future.
Sounds good, Wade. Sounds good, Wade. I look forward to working with you again too, and we'll talk soon.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Wade. Wow, there you go. Some actual direct feedback from one of your students that your training actually helped him out. That's got
to
be good.
Yeah, no, it's always good to hear. He makes an interesting point. I recently had someone criticize the titles of my classes, you know, and Wade just reminded me of this, about the fact that I used the word, like if you look at the names of some of the course titles, combative carbine skills
combative pistol skills 1 and 2.
Yeah, and somebody was saying, a lawyer friend of mine, he was kind of acquaintance, he says, well, geez, you know, man, I'd eat you up in court, you know, with something like that, because, you know, you're, you know, you're basically, you know, with a class title like that, you know, you're just basically saying that you're looking for a fight, you know, using the word combative. I mean, most people in the industry use the word defensive or something
defensive,
like that.
Defensive, right.
And I looked at him and I was just like, yeah, man, sure. You know, I mean, because I don't know, I'm not a lawyer. But, you know, it all, to me, it all goes back to mindset. And I tell people all the time, I say, I'm not in any way, shape, or form looking for any kind of fight. But when I use, you know, words have meaning, and this is a big thing in my classes is that I kind of harp on is that, you know, when you use words to describe things that you're teaching and different lexicon that you utilize, it leaves impressions in people's minds. And when I think of the word defensive, I automatically think, you know, back to my karate days when I, you know, buckled down into like the stance and waited for someone to come after me. I didn't go after them, you know, and
right.
I also think of reacting, you know, when you're defensive, you're reacting to somebody. And, you know, nowadays we just can't be like that. You know, the people, these criminals nowadays are far more aggressive. They're far more vicious. And so my mindset is I want to start right from the get-go with thinking combatively. And that doesn't mean I'm going out and attacking people. It just means that if I get to that stage where, you know, I'm in condition red, where I know something is just about to touch off, I'm going to go first. I'm going to act first, and I'm going to I'm going to paraphrase a quote from my dear friend Southnark. I'm going to take initiative on my adversaries, and
right.
It doesn't matter whether I'm empty hand or whether I have a tool. It's you know, my life's more important than sort of life of my family, and I can't worry about the legal ramifications. Although, you know, it's always a worry in the back of our mind, but if I wait for them to act first, then, you know, I'm my first indication that I'm being attacked is me being hurt, you know. So those words really mean a lot, and it's interesting the way
some of these recent home invasions, and they're just so violent, so brutal, and so well organized. You'd be a fool not to have the right mindset. You really would if you're really trying to, if you're serious about defense. You've got to keep an aggressive mindset to a point. I mean, you disarm or you try to defuse the situation as much as possible. There are situations where the fuse is already lit, and there's nothing you can do about it.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think 90% of the battle is an element of training that, again, I'll reference Southnark, Craig Douglas is his name. He's a trainer from down in Mississippi and a real good friend of mine, and he runs an excellent course. But he teaches an area of training that's relatively untouched or was untouched until he pretty much introduced it, and it's managing unknown contacts and understanding criminal assault. And, you know, and this is a perfect example of a guy who's got a military and a law enforcement background, and he actually took his law enforcement background and did studies on what happened to him when he was assaulted, you know, undercover as an undercover narc agent. And, you know, that information for citizens is huge, because if you correlate, you know, as an undercover narcotics agent to a citizen, that's really kind of like what we are. You know, we walk around with our guns concealed where it's not out in the open. We don't have a badge on our chest. And we never know when something's going to happen to us. And same thing for a narc, you know, agent, undercover agent, you know. And he, you know, what he did is every time he was assaulted, he would analyze the situation to figure out, well, why what went wrong? And I've really integrated a lot of his training and teaching into my program, because I feel it has such a good corollary to citizens. And, you know, I recommend anybody listening to, you know, look him up. If you're a citizen and you want some real world practical application of how to deal with that stuff before it happens, you know, he's the man to talk to.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Anyway. What was his name again?
Craig Douglas. And, he goes by Southnark on the internet.
Okay.
If you just Google Southnark, he'll come up. He's a very good friend of mine, and I can't recommend him highly enough for the training that he offers. He's got that background. He's got that real world experiential background of a guy who's seen a lot of violence, been shot, been stabbed, been assaulted, and on the job and off the job. And but he also looks through, the reason I like him, and obviously, you know, I'm friends with him, but the reason I really like his training is because he looks at things through the glasses of a, you know, through that filter of a citizen. He doesn't just teach from the law enforcement perspective, you know.
Sure.
And that's odd.
Yeah.
That's really
different.
That
is unique. We've got another caller for you. S.C.
Sure.
Marr from Pennsylvania. You're on Radio Free ArfCom with Chris Fry.
Hey, Chris.
How you doing?
Not too bad. Hey, I did your course up in Sayre here last summer.
Oh, great.
And this is just a kudos to you. And want to tell everybody that if they ever get the opportunity to take one of your courses, that they should definitely do it. It was very informative. I thought it was well run, very educational, and your failure drill is just outstanding.
Which course did you take?
Your malfunction drill for the carbine course.
Yeah.
Which
carbine course, combative carbine skills 1 and 2.
Yep.
Okay.
Right.
What, is that a 1 day class?
Yes,
it was.
And you said you liked his failure drill, huh? Stay on the line for a second, Essie Moore. So how about for people that, you know, they live in California or they live in Washington State or Oregon or Idaho out here west in Utah like I do. What from your perspective as a professional trainer, why don't you give us a couple of drills that people can do at their own range, at their local range, on their own, just some things to help them be a little bit better with their, as you would say, combative firearm skills?
Well, let's talk about, how about we talk a little bit about multitasking and a real good drill that we utilize, we call it one of our reality-based drills, is you got to do this with a partner. So you go out to the range and you put up a target and, again, every drill you shoot with any kind of firearm is a marksmanship drill. So accuracy is number one. So at the end of the drill, even though you might have performed the drill adequately, if you didn't hit the target, then you're wrong, and you should strive for that precise marksmanship. But this drill, basically what we do is we take one guy as the guy who runs the drill, a shooter, an observer is what we call it, and the observer stands to the rear of the shooter and starts talking to him. And the job of the shooter is to try not to get interrogatory with the observer. And what we're trying to do is we're in a safe way on a square range, we're trying to replicate the verbal interaction or that diffusion that you and I were just talking about a little while ago.
Uh-huh.
And try to show the shooter how difficult it is to actually, you know, speak. And then when they're given a fire command to draw their handgun out and engage the target accurately, because if the observer's real good at distracting the guy, talking to him about something, and trying to cognitively engage the shooter, it's very, very difficult to multitask and do those several different elements at one time. And there's a lot of different ways we do this in class, and we try to elicit a little bit of a fear response. And, you know, sometimes we, you know, ramp things up and use some bad language and call people names, but, you know, that's just to mimic what a criminal might do on the street if they're coming up to you and either using aggressive verbal against you, or they're trying to ruse you in some way, you know, try to get close to you to enact a plan of action.
Catch you off guard, yeah, I like that. So the observer will stand behind the shooter, and they just engage in conversation, any random normal conversation, and then at some point in the conversation...
Well, you know, you want to try to replicate, like, what would happen on the street. You know, maybe I might stand behind you, John, say you're the shooter and you're facing downrange and you got whatever target, and your job is to put 2, 3, 4, 5 rounds, whatever you guys determine, into that target in a specific zone. And so I'll stand to the left of you if you're a right-handed shooter. I'll stand to your left side, and I'll act like maybe I'm coming up to you at the pump at a gas station. Hey, man, what's up? What's up? What do you got in your pockets there? Looks like you got something there in your pocket. Show me what's in your pocket there, man. Is that a wallet? Hey, man, let me see your wallet. Let me see that wallet. Hand me that fucking wallet, you know? And pardon my language, but, you know, we start to ramp things up like that and try to elicit a little bit of adrenal response in the shooter to really simulate that real situation that could happen. And then somewhere in there, I, as the guy giving the verbal, will say, gun. And on the gun command, your job is not only to talk to me and try to keep me, you know, use verbal to diffuse the situation, you know, whatever you want to say, stop, don't come any closer, you know, don't move, whatever you want to say back to me. But when you hear that gun command, that means I'm pulling a gun out. And so you have to pull your gun out and engage the target.
Oh, wow, I like that drill. I really do. S.C. Moore, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, would you like to attend another one of Chris's classes?
Sure.
Okay, send, you know how to send me an IM at AR15.com, right?
Yeah.
Okay, send me an IM, and we'll make sure you get one of these $25 gift certificates. We've got one more $25 gift certificate to give away.
Cool.
The next caller gets it. The next caller for Chris, we'll get one of these gift certificates. So call in. We got lines open right now. I have a question for you, Chris. As far as women are concerned, most of us have wives or girlfriends or whatever. Have you trained a lot of women, or do you get a lot of couples come in to train together?
Yeah. I get a lot of I get a lot more couples than I do single females. Although we've had a decent number, but recently in the last couple of years, we've got a lot of husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend teams that come into a class and they want to do the class together, whatever it is. As a matter of fact, at the class in Sayre, there was a husband, wife couple that did the carbine class together, and they did fantastic, you know, and I always like seeing that because I think that's paramount. If you live with somebody and they, you know, I think they should know how to shoot too, just in case, you know, something happens to you. And so when I get the opportunity to work with a couple like that, it's a great honor for me.
Okay, I was looking on your website. It looks like you guys actually do some force-on-force training. You offer some force-on-force training if people want it. Is that right?
Yep.
And so, like, say there's a group of friends, you know, we got five or six buddies that go to the range all the time, and they decide, you know what, maybe we want some training, and we don't want to go spend all this money at some of these top-end, high-end places, but we want to get some quality training. Can they contact you as a group and schedule an independent class, independent from what's on your calendar there?
Sure. That's pretty much... The way I got started was people were contacting me through ARFCOM and through other forums and just saying, you know, geez, what do we need to do to get you to come down here and do a class? We saw it on your website or we saw a video or whatever, and we're real interested and we'd like you to come down and do something. And basically what I tell people is just, you know, drop me an IM or an email and we'll figure it out. You know, we need a range, or if we're for a force-on-force class, we don't even need a range. I mean, I've done some of these force-on-force classes in, like, karate dojos, and I've done them in people's backyards. I've done them in – we did one in a public park one time, luckily with no problems. Nowadays people see you running around with, like, airsoft pistols or a Sims gun, and you know, you're asking for trouble. But that was several years ago, and it was a pretty underpopulated area, so it wasn't a big deal.
Sure.
But we've done them all over, and, you know, they're a lot of fun. The force-on-force training is essential. I think, you know, no matter what you do, no matter what you train, eventually you have to get to that point where you're, you know, it's almost like, it's like empty hand fighting, right? I mean, if I am in a karate class for, you know, 5 years and just punching in the air and never actually striking someone, how do I know whether I really have it in me to do that?
Right.
And the same thing kind of applies to the firearms part of it, is that if I carry a gun and I, you know, I've shot some paper targets and I've tried to make my training as real as possible, but the day comes and I really have to use it, do I have a mental block? Do I have an emotional block? Is my belief system keeping me from pulling the trigger? And you know, that force-on-force training is that area where we can determine whether people have these kind of obstacles, and we can try to work around them, aside from the fact that it's a good opportunity to test the skills that you've learned live fire.
Sure.
So that's so
really, I really
doing.
Like your approach.
I'm actually
training.
Doing a force-on-force class down in Jersey in May. So the guys down there in Jersey really like that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay, cool. Which one is that? May?
May 30th. It's a CQE. We call it close quarter engagement.
Close quarters engagement at the Buckeye Gun Club. I can see it right there.
Yeah.
And like, you're still registering for it. You got open spots. Okay. Wade,
yeah,
if you're still
about,
listening, give me an IM. Wade, give me an IM on AR15.com, and I'll see that you get one of these $25 gift certificates to train with Chris. That's all the time we have for you this week, Chris. Will you come back later in the year?
I sure will. Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks for being on with us. That's Chris Fry from MDTS Training. Their website is mdtstraining.com. Check them out if you're looking for some very cost-effective, high-quality training. Get yourself up to speed with the weapons you own. Don't just let them be safe, queens. Get out there and shoot them. Get yourself fully trained on them. You owe it to yourself as a gun owner to do that. Looks like we're going to have Stump the Deej, our latest and greatest game show here on Radio Free Arfcom in just a minute, as soon as our producer extraordinaire Seth gets things set up. Just perusing the forums today, here's a few things I learned from reading AR15.com today. I learned that the Marine Corps are going to field more grenade launchers this year. Looks like they're going to field nearly 2,200 new M32 launchers. And the Marine Corps is also changing their ammunition to use the SOST ammunition that was used for the SOCOM is using in their SCAR carbines. Apparently this ammunition is a lot more accurate in short-barreled rifles. So if you did not get on AR15.com today, that's what you missed out on. I also learned that some of you have excellent taste in burgers. Ron NOC, put together the best burger you've ever eaten thread, and you go through and look at some of the pictures of these burgers. Oh, man, it'll make you hungry. It'll make you really hungry. Oh, one other thread that I saw today, and I got a kick out of this. T. Lyle Design, one of our industry partners, put a thread up about Chinese gangs now rocking hand shotguns. And there's a picture of this abomination. I don't know what this thing is. Look, it's a 12-gauge revolver with a Beretta, some type of had a Beretta frame on there. It says made in the USA. These Taiwanese gangbangers are using these in Taiwan. They cost between $7,000 and $9,000 per shotgun revolver. Take a look at this thread if you haven't seen it yet. The thread's name is Chinese Gangs Now Rocking Hand Shotguns. And take a look at this thing. It is a monstrosity. I got a kick out of that. Okay, we're ready for Stump the Deej. We've got Deej. He is AR15.com's resident guru. He never forgets anything on AR15.com. And his contestant today is going to be Wheelchair Man. Are you guys online with me?
Yes. Hello.
Okay.
Hey.
Okay, sounds like we've got both of you. Here's how it works. Wheelchair Man will ask Deej three questions. These questions are involving threads that were in general discussion and involving members, not particular information in threads, but members, maybe who started a thread or who did this or who did that. Deej has to answer all three questions right, or he is stumped. Now, if he answers all three questions right, he gets to ask Wheelchair Man one question. If Wheelchair Man gets that question right, he has stumped the Deej, and he will win a free membership renewal at the current level he is at. Are we ready to go, guys?
Yes.
Wheelchair Man.
Deej is going down, man.
I love it.
We'll
I love it.
That.
Okay, Wheelchair Man, ask your first question for Stump the Deej.
Question number one is, who started the idea of ARFTown?
Of what?
Who started the idea of ARFTown?
5-7 Strat.
Oh, wow.
Good job.
That is the right answer. Oh, my goodness. The Deej is the man. Okay. Question number two, Wheelchair Man. Go ahead.
Hi, Deej. I went back into the archives for this one, so I'm going to get you. Who was the infamous rant written by Mick Uzi directed at?
Grandman.
Wow.
That is also
that is
very
correct.
Solid.
Deej is 2-for-2. Oh, my goodness.
I'm not even mad right now. I'm amazed.
Okay, go ahead with the third question. This is your last and final chance to stump the Deej.
What ARFCOM members found the infamous Looty?
Who
infamous
found
what?
Looty?
Who found the Looty?
Jay Dussel. Okay, come on! I mean, you're going to have to find me some harder questions than that.
You've got to be kidding me.
Do you need tougher questions than that, you say, Deej?
Sorry?
Deej, do you need tougher questions than that? Deej just got all three questions right. The first question was, who was McGuzzi's famous rant directed at? The answer was Grandman. He got that right. Or, I'm sorry, that was the second question. The first question was, who started the idea of ARFTown? That was 57 Strat. Deej got that right. Now, I want you guys to know, I know the questions are going to be asked beforehand. Deej has no clue what the questions are going to be. The third question was, who found the infamous Looty? If everybody remembers the guy that had all the Heineken in the shopping cart during the Hurricane Katrina incident. One of our members went out and actually found this guy, Ludi, and it was Jay Dessel. And Deej got it right, so Deej does not get stumped today. But Wheelchair Man.
I am going to get stumped. I guarantee it.
We're gonna have Deej ask you the question anyway, just to see if you would have got it right or wrong. Go ahead, Deej, ask him the question you had for him if you would have.
All right. The question is, who was the guy that started the fire mission starting thread about Jim Zumbo? I have absolutely no idea. That would be IIRC.
It was IIRC. Is that right? Okay. I'm telling you guys, it's going to be amazing if someone can actually ever stump the Deej. But Wheelchair Man, because you were the first guy that came on the show and you were the only one that was willing to sack up and try it against the Deej, we've got a special gift for you. You're going to get either a free AR15.com hat or a t-shirt. Send me an IM and I'll make sure you get those out to you, okay?
Awesome, cool. And before I get off of here, I would like to say that G-Series FAL is pretty awesome for taking the punishment that he did in team this week. And Mary Curie really avoided the wrath of AR-15, because if any other member had done what 7-3 did, he'd have been probably banned.
Are you talking about the bear pit thread with 7-3 and the guy who
did
the Marines? Oh yeah. That was an interesting thread. If you're not a member of AR-15.com, a paid member, a team member, it's worth the $24 a year just to go to the bear pit. Some of the threads in there, man, you'll see stuff in there you never thought you'd see on AR-15.com. Hey, I want to thank Deej. Deej, we're going to have you back next week if we can find anybody man enough to try to take it to you, okay?
Okay.
Okay, Wheelchair Man, thanks for being part of the show.
Thank you. I'll send you an IM.
Okay, send it to me right away. Thanks, guys. We're going to have Phil Schreier here on in just a minute. I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of the things I've seen today on AR15.com. I spent a little time perusing the general discussion, as we all do. We all like to spend a lot of time on there. I'm trying to get Mark LaRue on the show. Mark LaRue, if you are listening, I've tried to send you IMs, but you don't accept IMs. I've tried to send you some emails. Please contact me. I'd love to have you on the show. You're a very, very popular guy here on AR15.com, and I want to get you on as soon as we can. I spoke earlier, you guys, about the Facebook group for the officer in Palo Alto, California. Don't forget to go check out that Facebook group. Join it if you feel it's something that's worth your time. The officer in California said he wanted to prone out people that open carry in California and then basically ventilate them if they make any furtive moves was his word. It was quite a shocking bit of work. And so go check out that Facebook group. Join it if you feel it's something worth your time. Okay, right now we've got Phil Schreier. He is from the National Museum, and he's got a speech today. Are you there, Phil?
Yes, I sure am.
Hey, thanks for being a part of our show. I'd like to have you on once a month, if possible, to come and talk about. You've got so many great pieces there in the museum that I don't think a few minutes here with us will give it justice. So if possible, I'd like to have you on once a month to talk about a different piece each month. Is that okay?
Consider it a deal.
Okay. What have you got for us this week?
Well, we were talking earlier about a new exhibit that's going to debut at the National Firearms Museum at NRA headquarters coming. And it's actually a sequel to an exhibit we had back in 2002. Called Real Guns of Real, R-E-E-L, Heroes. And it's all about movie guns. And this exhibit's entitled Hollywood Guns.
Are you there?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah. You cut out a little bit. Go ahead. You are talking about Hollywood, the real guns from real...
Real Guns of Real Heroes. And it's the new exhibit's called Hollywood Guns. And it's all about firearms that we've borrowed from various friends of the NRA out in Hollywood, California, and some private collections around the country.
Okay.
And we specifically for our first presentation on your radio show here, that we talk about probably the biggest gun in the collection, and that is the Barrett M107 used in The Hurt Locker.
Oh, wow. In the movie The Hurt Locker. Now, I have not had a chance to see this movie yet, but I've heard nothing but good reviews about it. I'm definitely going to go see it here. And it looks like it's going to be up for a few Academy Awards as well. So
Nine Academy Awards.
Oh, wow.
It was just released on DVD a couple weeks ago. And it's a fantastic film. And in the film, the actor Anthony Mackie, and who's playing Sergeant Sanborn, and actor Jeremy Renner, who plays Staff Sergeant William James, used the Barrett 50 cal to take out some insurgents in Iraq after they attempt to rescue a team of contractors led by Rafe Fiennes, who actually had the Barrett with them at the time that they got attacked. And this piece is a fully operational M107. That comes from Cinema Weaponry out in Glendale, California, and is, you know, the working gun, and it was quite
a... It's not just a prop gun. This is a real Barrett 50.
It's a real Barrett 50. It's not a rubber or latex copy of one. It actually goes bang. And we have it in the museum for... we're going to run this exhibit for about a year and keep it till early next spring.
Oh, okay. So now, for people who don't know about the NRA Heritage Museum, is it the National Firearms Museum? But what website can they go to? The only website I could find was on nragive.com.
No, it's actually you can go directly to the museum's brand new website at nramuseum.org.
Nramuseum.org,
which is a very big interactive. Website with a lot of flash-driven guides to the galleries. The director of the museum, Jim Sapica, and the two senior curators, myself and Doug Wicklund, escort the visitors through the galleries talking about specific firearms that are on display. There are 15 galleries and about 2,500 guns on exhibit. And we individually on the website talk in video, you know, flash presentations about, talk about 80 of our favorite pieces that are in the galleries.
Oh, wow. I'm looking at the website now. I actually got onto it, nramuseum.org, and wow, this is a great website. There is all kinds of stuff going on here.
Thank you.
So a little bit more about this Barrett 50. How do you guys get this? Does someone offer you, hey, we want to put this in the museum? Do you guys contact them and say, hey, this would be great if we had it in the museum? How do you guys go about procuring some of these pieces?
Well, it started out with us, you know, kind of looking back on the, you know, we've been open since 1935. This is our 75th anniversary year. And, out of all the temporary exhibits we've held in the William B. Ruger Gallery of the museum since we opened at our new headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia back in 1998, the movie gun exhibit was the biggest exhibit we ever had. It was huge compared to all the other museums in Washington in 2002 that suffered massive losses in tourism because of the post 9/11. You know, people not wanting to travel.
Right.
We went up 40% that year.
Oh, wow.
And the only exhibit catalog we produced that is sold out. We sold, you know, well over a couple thousand catalogs, and we thought it had been about 8 years since we ran that exhibit, and since that time, some great movies have come out. Some real neat guns have had some real neat use in a lot of these films. Appaloosa, a new Western starring Ed Harris and Viggo Mortensen. I mean, how many films have you seen with a double barrel Colt 8 gauge, prominently featured in the film? Which is kind of funny because the movie makes a special note of it being a Colt 8-gauge double barrel, when in fact Colt only made one 8-gauge double barrel shotgun in their entire history, and it was a presentation piece to Grover Cleveland and is actually one of the national treasures we have on display in our museum. So we actually have the only thing. I mean, the only 8-gauge Colt on exhibit, but in the movie, Viggo Mortensen has one.
A lot of people here museum.
But the Barrett came to us from a cinema weaponry, and they supply, you know, guns to the film industry for decades now. And we're very fortunate to have friends there. They operate out of the old Stembridge gun rental facility in Glendale, where they've been renting guns since D.W. Griffith first came to the Hollywood Hills in 1912 to start making movies. They actually rented guns for Birth of a Nation when it was filmed in 1915.
So a lot of people hear the word museum and they think, oh boy, it's just going to be nothing but old flint locks and old muskets and stuff like that. But you guys actually have all kinds of modern firearms in there.
Well, we really do. The timeline that we have represented starts off with crossbows and hand cannons, the first projectile arms.
Uh-huh.
And it weaves a thread through American history that takes you up to the modern conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we've got you know, the latest in law enforcement on display, as well as we actually have our own Barrett M82 that was used in Desert Storm back in 91. That was the Marine Corps used gun during that war, and that came directly from Ronnie Barrett, who's on our board of directors.
Oh, okay, and we love Ronnie Barrett. Everybody loves Ronnie Barrett. If you're if you're ever in Virginia, you go to Washington, D.C. With the family on vacation, book some time to go to this museum, the National Firearms Museum in Fairfax, Virginia. It will be worth every second of your time, I can tell just by the website. I myself have never been there, but the next time I go back east, that's one place I am definitely going. Phil, I want to thank you for being on the show with us today, and we're going to have you on next month here, and you're going to have a couple different pieces to talk about for us. Is that right?
Absolutely, and you know, call any time. The museum's open 7 days a week. The admission's free. We're located right off of Interstate Route 66. And the intersection of U.S. Route 50 in Fairfax at the NRA headquarters. We're open 9:30 to 5 Sunday through Friday, and on Saturdays 9:30 to 7.
And the admission is free, so you can take the whole family there, and it's not going to cost you anything.
That's right. And we have one of the largest bookstores for firearms-related materials in the country. We do a tremendous, about 70% of our gift shop sales volume is in books. So if you come down there, you know, make sure that you bring some spending loot, because the bookstore alone is worth just the trip.
I can't wait till I get a chance to check it out. Okay, Phil, I look forward to talking to you again next month. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank you. You all take care.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Phil Schreier, one of the senior curators at the National Firearms Museum in Fairfax, Virginia. Right now, it's time for everybody's favorite segment, Old Painless and the Box of Truth.
Let's open the Box of Truth. Here is Old Painless.
Hello everyone, this is Old Painless with the Box of Truth. Today I'm going to answer a couple of questions sent in by interested listeners. I would also encourage any listeners that have a question to feel free to send it in and we'll try to answer it for you. Question number one, is it true that a 5.56 bullet will tumble when it hits a body and that it will follow bones or change its direction drastically? This question in different forms is often asked about the 5.56 round. When Mr. Stoner developed his rifle and chambered it for the 5.56 round, the cartridge was most commonly loaded with a 55-grain full metal jacket bullet with a cannelure. A cannelure is an indented belt that goes around the circumference of the bullet. The bullet is usually crimped into the case at the cannelure. These cartridges could reach a velocity of over 3,200 feet per second. The bullet, which, by the way, is a part of the cartridge that goes downrange, was designed so that when it hit an enemy troop, it would turn sideways or yaw. Some folks use the term tumble, but that is not as accurate as if we say it yaws, because it does not usually tumble like a buzzsaw. Instead, when it hits a body, it turns sideways and then is designed to break at the cannelure, and the back end of the bullet will then usually shatter into many small pieces, each making its own wound channel. The front of the bullet will usually stay together, and usually this penetrates the most. When I was at medic school at Fort Sam Houston back in 1970, I was training to be a 91 Alpha combat medic. We were shown a lot of films where doctors worked on wounded soldiers. Some of these wounds were from 5.56 rounds, and I'll have to admit that they were pretty gruesome. A small bullet at high velocity that yaws and breaks apart will cause very gruesome wounds. But the rumor that these bullets tumble in flight to the target is totally wrong, and they do not always follow any certain path when they hit a bad guy. They often take unexpected turns, and the wound channels can be very unexpected. But one thing is sure, they're very effective at creating wounds or even death. Some modern bullets are now loaded into the 5.56 cartridge, which are heavier, and some of them can't be driven to the high velocities of the old 55-grain rounds. The result is that some of these new bullets do not yaw and break apart, and some folks believe that they're not as effective as the old M193 55-grain bullet. Question number two. How important is training for defensive use of a weapon? There's probably no subject that is more important than this one. I went through basic training in the Army in 1970, and we trained with the M16 rifles. I learned to disassemble and clean, reassemble the rifle, and I qualified with it on the range. I was a police officer as a young man and carried a pistol and a shotgun and qualified with both as a police officer. I was trained as an NRA instructor in rifles, pistols, and shotguns. I thought I was pretty well trained. But then I went to Thunder Ranch for the Defensive Handgun 1 class. I was in for a really rude awakening. I learned more in that week than I had in my entire life about the defensive use of a pistol. I came to realize that I really knew a lot about guns, but I knew very little about how to fight with one. There was so much to learn and retain that I felt like I was trying to take a drink from a 3-inch fire hose. It was just overwhelming. I returned later for the urban rifle class, then again for the defensive pistol 2, and finally for the defensive shotgun class. In every class, I learned a ton of new stuff that I'd never known before and never even thought about. My best advice for someone interested in the defensive use of a weapon system is to get some professional training. Don't waste your money on more and more expensive weapons, because the best weapon in the world is not going to help you if you don't know how to fight with it. Instead, get some training. It'll be the best money you ever spent. Then you can come home and practice what you learn until it becomes a part of you. Practice, practice, practice. Besides, practice, if done right, is fun. Why? Well, because it's fun to shoot stuff.
Okay, that was Old Painless and another outstanding Box of Truth for us. You can always check out Old Painless at www.boxotruth.com. He's got a lot of good stuff there. If you like guns and you want to know about terminal ballistics and bullets going through different mediums and some of the myths, he's the original firearms mythbuster. So check him out at boxotruth.com. Right now, We've got a special segment for you. We've got a man named Micah Clark from Camp Patriot, and his organization is an outstanding organization to help our disabled veterans when they come back from war and they're severely disabled. Micah, are you online with me?
I'm here. How you doing?
Hey, I'm sorry we took a little bit longer to get you on, but I'm glad we have you now.
Hey, no problem. I appreciate it.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Camp Patriot? And his website is camppatriot.org. You can go check it out there. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you guys do.
Well, in 2004, I came back working in Afghanistan, and I had the idea of building a facility where I could bring disabled veterans in the outdoors and reconnect with the life through outdoor recreational therapy. And so our mission is to take United States disabled veterans on outdoor adventures. That's our mission.
So what kind of adventures have you taken some of these disabled veterans on? I remember you actually told me you've actually taken some hunting. You've climbed some pretty big mountains and stuff.
Correct. Yeah, we do hunting trips, fishing trips, skiing, snowmobiling, motorcycle riding, all those kind of adventures. And our pinnacle event is each year climbing Mount Rainier. It's probably the most challenging adventure that we've put the guys on so far. And that is a 14,410-foot mountain. So it's quite a challenge when you're blind or missing your legs or missing a limb of some kind. It's a challenging event if you're able-bodied. So 50% of able-bodied people that attempt the mountain each year do not make it. So it is quite a challenge, and it's probably the event that creates that paradigm shift we look for mostly, where we can show these guys and gals that, hey, you know, you're disabled, but life isn't over, and we actually show them they have abilities to get in the outdoors and not look at the disability.
Wow, that's amazing. How does the hunting work? How do you take some of these guys that have been blinded? How do you take them hunting? Can you explain that for our listeners?
Yeah, it's depending on the disability, our probably the most demanding one that we put together is I took our national spokesman at the time, Ryan Jobe. He was a Navy SEAL, and he was blinded over in Iraq, and on top of the mountain, he was on our second year climb, and he wanted to, he expressed to me that he grew up hunting in the Issaquah area of Washington State, and he and his lieutenant at the time were actually, planning a trip to go elk hunting, and then they wanted to go to the Midwest to do some bird hunting, and then he was injured, and he thought, well, that dream's never gonna happen. They weren't gonna be able to hunt since he was blind. And we've been working with a piece of equipment, a model Winchester 70, and we mounted a Carl Zeiss scope and a Oregon camera system behind it with a gasket between it. And with the coax, you could actually plug it into a big Canon HD camera. And so, you know, from about 10 feet away, we're pulling out that LCD on that big camera, and we can actually see the reticle. And so I called him up about 2 months later and said, hey, how would you like to go elk hunting this fall? And he says, get out of here. How am I going to ever elk hunt? So, well, we'd worked on this technology. We jerry-rigged it, and we're going to give it a shot. And I wanted him, as being our national spokesman, to be the first one to attempt it. And we were successful. He actually bagged a 980-pound elk, and his lieutenant played his eyes for him. So it was a neat story, and it came full circle with the both of them going out hunting.
Wow. So he was behind the gun, and you guys could see the reticle. You could see a sight reticle on the LCD screen coming through the high-def camera. And so you guys would just kind of, okay, a little bit higher, a little bit to the right. Okay, you're right on right there.
Exactly. And it was, I tell you, just the dynamics of two people trying to coordinate one shot and then, of course, having an animal that isn't sitting still. It was quite a few variables to come in alignment to get that shot. We actually took us about 3 hours to get an animal within range and squeeze that trigger. So it was quite a bit of work, but it came together. I mean, how else are you going to get a guy that's blind out hunting?
Yeah, that is amazing. That is an amazing story. So Ryan was your national spokesman, but he recently passed away. Is that correct?
Correct. He became one of my best friends over a three-year period, and he was up for his last surgery. He came through the surgery, and then next morning I got a phone call that he had passed away. They said he had aspirated and died, and we've been looking at different reasons what happened, but he should have been dead on a rooftop 3 years prior is what his family and his teammates had told me, and we were lucky to have Ryan for three more years and create quite a change in his life, it was a tough fall, and we're proceeding forward with some of his team members that have been injured, and doing some exciting things. So.
Wow, and Ryan's got a great story. You can check out his story, www.camppatriot.org. There's a link there to Ryan's memorial page, and it's quite moving. So you guys, the goal for Camp Patriot is to eventually have your own little ranch where disabled veterans can come and do some of the outdoor activities that they loved before they were disabled?
Yes, sir. That's we got 2.3 million disabled vets out there, and of course you've got to look between the guy that's got 5% hearing loss to, you know, some of these folks that are pretty injured with long-term disabilities, with missing legs and arms and those kind of things. And the overall goal was to build eventually a 30,000 square foot lodge that I could bring 1,000 veterans through a year. And we're inching our way. I mean, we've been operating on a dime, and it's actually about $100,000 over 4 years, and we've taken 100 vets on different excursions, everything from Russian boar hunting to bear hunting in Vancouver Island to, you know, the climbs and those kind of things. And so we're trying to get into the fundraising and get some different corporations involved and hopefully get a home here shortly. We've had a gentleman out here in Eastern Washington wanted to donate a ranch and a will, and there's been some complications with that, so we're still looking at some different properties out here that we could possibly build a 5,000 square foot timber frame type facility. We can give them that cowboy ranch experience, you know, out bird hunting and, of course, fishing on the Columbia and Snake Rivers and continue to do the external trips, because they'll never be a one-stop shop for everything we want to do. I've been pressured by the team to go after McKinley someday, and so once we raise the funds, we'll probably start tackling some bigger mountains and some more adventures.
McKinley's a big mountain. That's nothing to sneeze at there. I was reading on your website. I saw you guys just recently got an airplane to help you go and pick up some of these veterans and take them on their adventures. Is that right?
Yeah, we have. It's unfortunately we don't have the funds to operate that airplane, but it's a 1957 Twin Beach Bonanza, and it saw its time in combat as well. It's actually got a bullet hole, and they used those airplanes in Korea and Vietnam with a signal corps, and they'd actually drag an antenna out the back end and capture enemy transmissions.
And, oh, wow.
The board has kind of, you know, looked at saying, hey, we really need to sell that airplane and we could use the cash. And I've thought about, you know, what we can do. It's not quite the market out there right now to be selling airplanes. But, you know, if the right idea came along or if we could able to maybe, you know, transfer that into a smaller airplane that we could utilize, then it'd be a great airplane to fly guys around the Pacific Northwest. It's an old tank, but she's, stripped right now for parachuting. There's a couple buddies of mine that had a drop zone that actually donated to us. And it's just kind of a neat piece of history that could still be utilized, but we'll just have to see how the funding goes.
Sure, okay. And people want to donate some time instead of money to organization. Is it possible for them to do that, to maybe come help volunteer with some of your activities, or how does that work?
Well, it's right now, until we actually get a facility going, it's pretty slim. We don't have a lot of opportunities for folks because I just don't have the funding to keep doing. We don't do weekly trips. It's on the climb, we've had a lot of people come out there. This year is going to be being the fourth year of even a bigger event, so we get a lot of folks to volunteer and help Sherpa gear up to 10,000 feet. But once we get this Eastern Washington area, so we get this land in place and we get a facility, then there'll be a lot more need, because I think we'll be able to bring more folks in the Pacific Northwest. And then once we get this transportation issue settled, then we'll be able to get more folks out. And, of course, then the demand for volunteers will be a little bit higher.
Right, absolutely. Once again, the website is www.camppatriot.org. These guys are just an amazing organization. Some of the stuff you've done on here, it looks like you're actually starting to get some mainline sponsors on board. I know it's not quite enough what you need yet, but you're actually starting to get some notice. Looks like Pioneer Log Homes of British Columbia, Jim Shockey's actually come to help you out. Is that right?
Yeah, we've done a little bit with them, and then Pioneer Log Homes has been fantastic. You know, about 2005, I had a gentleman want to donate all the logs to build that big lodge, and which was a big piece of the puzzle, but I had to explain to him it's a huge puzzle.
Right.
You know, so we had about $2 million worth of logs this guy wanted to drop on our lap, and I said, hey, Tim, I really appreciate that, you know, we're just not ready. And then Pioneer came into the picture and said, hey, we'll take those lodgepole pine and trade up for cedar to build this facility. And, you know, God bless them. Eventually, hopefully, we'll get there. But, yeah, newest thing that we've tried to team up with some of the corporations, like Crimson Trace Laser Company out of Portland, Oregon. I think I'm safe in explaining to them that we've we've pretty much come to the conclusion they're going to look at lasers that are military and law enforcement, look at their margins, see what they could donate dollar-wise per laser. And so I'm trying to team with a lot of corporations. It's a broad spectrum. It doesn't have to be anything in the outdoor industry. It could be any kind of corporation that looks at, you know, millions of units of something. If they can donate 10 cents on that unit, that's huge for us. So we're hoping to kind of grow the coffers, so to speak, and raise enough funds through a lot of corporations donating that way.
Wow, that's amazing. That is really amazing. So you say you actually have taken some veterans skydiving once they've come back. Is that right?
Well, we haven't done that yet. We've got the aircraft, and I've got a lot of guys that have the jump experience, but eventually that's what I'd like to take some guys out. Our insurance company just absolutely loves me.
yeah, I can imagine.
Come back to with quite a few high quotes that we just basically say, guys, we just can't afford that kind of insurance. And of course, they scratch their heads and can't believe the things that we're doing with our vets. But it's really what I'm after is that paradigm shift. And, you know, the other thing that we are, unlike any other organizations, I'm trying to get some of my World War II, Korean, and Vietnam vets out. And, you know, a lot of great programs out there, but a lot of them are catering just to this younger generation. And I've got a lot of time with those guys. You know, our World War II generation, just due to age, we're losing a lot of those folks. So the quicker I can get this facility built, the faster I can get some of those folks out there. And really, I'm not going to create a paradigm shift in their lives. It's really going to be a thank you and for their service and get them out there and enjoy the outdoors. And, you know, hopefully with the younger generation, I'm going to have a lot of time to create that shift and say, hey, life isn't over. Let's press forward and see what abilities you got.
Yeah, I really like what you're trying to do. You were telling me a little bit about you guys are going to be involved in the Pony Express event later this year.
Yeah, that's just an outstanding event. It's a friend of mine, Jack Rhodes, out of Utah. His great-great-grandfather was Major Egan Howard, who was the lieutenant in control of the ride through Utah. And so he is in charge of that portion of the ride. And I don't know if many of your listeners knew, but prior to 9/11 happening, we had a couple SF guys that were still doing the pack mule training, the horse training, and I think Big Army was kind of scratching their head saying, why are we doing this? And then the towers got hit, and we were thrust into Afghanistan, and it became a pretty valuable asset to have. So I've contacted through our connections there. We're looking to get a couple SF guys to go on a good portion of the ride through Utah, and we're going to have Wrangler involved with us. They're starting a new National Patriot program, and we're hoping Camp Patriot's a big portion of that. And you're going to start seeing that take off in all the PBRs across the nation. So our hat's off to Wrangler. They're doing a great job, and we're really looking forward to partnering with them. And so we'll have the guys in some Wrangler shirts and possibly Justin Brands involved and get these guys on some horseback rides throughout a good portion of Utah. That's about a 380-mile ride. So we're going to put them on the saddle as much as they want to be involved, and it should be a great event.
Okay, I actually live in Salt Lake City, so when you come out here, you're going to have to get in touch with me, and we'll meet up.
Exactly, yeah, and if anybody out there in Utah, I mean, we'll be at the ride. We'll end up having a celebration there at Pioneer Village, and I've been on their site briefly, and it looks like a pretty neat historic spot, and then the ride will continue on that evening towards Wyoming, and then across back to St. Joseph, Missouri is where it'll end up. It's a 1,900-mile ride, and those boys were pretty tough back in the day. There was, at the height of the thing, 80 riders and 400 horses. And those guys would cover some serious distance.
Wow.
I think about 60 to 120 miles a day is what one rider would do, which is pretty phenomenal.
And get chased by Indians half the time, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, it was a dangerous route. And, of course, imagine just bearing that in the wintertime going over the Sierra Nevadas. And so it's a neat historic ride. It's the 150th anniversary. And, yeah, get on that Pony Express Association webpage and check it out. They'll have a lot of information there. But we're hoping to get some good promotions out of this thing and show these guys a great adventure and be another neat way for us to touch the public and say, hey, look at what we're doing with these guys and give them those opportunities.
Okay, this is Micah Clark from CampPatriot.org. I want to thank you for coming on the show, Micah. Can we have you on again a little bit later in the year?
Hey, I'd love to be on the air. And, yeah, all the listeners out there, and I sure appreciate the support. And, yeah, get on our site and check us out.
If you're looking for a good organization to donate.
VBSRadio.com.
apologize we ran a little bit long, but we're going to try to have you on here as long as we can until Seth kicks us off the air. Why don't you explain Going Galt? Because I didn't do a really good job of it. Explain your whole idea and the concept you came up with for this.
Well, the idea behind it was essentially the time frame was one of where healthcare looked like it was just going to happen. It was nothing more than formalities ahead of the process, and it was just going to come in place. We just had to figure out how we were going to deal with it more than anything else. Fortunately, no longer the case anymore, but the idea is still in play, and glad to hear you were plugging the thread earlier. There's way too many ideas in there for me to cover in a single broadcast. So that's sort of the bank of ideas for anyone who wants to go and check it out.
Yeah, we'll check out. We'll try to talk about a couple of the ideas each week. I got through maybe 4 pages, and I think it's up to 12 pages now, that thread. And there are some of the ideas that people have in there are outstanding. What have you done, and what are the basics that someone could do to get started going Galt?
Well, the idea of going Galt is essentially reducing the amount of money that you're feeding what you perceive to be as a robbing beast, something taking away your rightfully earned money and giving it to people who are doing nothing for it. It's essentially the basic concept, then, is a way to reduce your tax burden, since that money is ultimately going to these socialist concepts. One way to start is to identify what you consider to be your needs. Now, this is beyond Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, shelter, water, and can extend into areas of such as, well, I don't really need the internet to survive, but I really enjoy it. So that's an expense that I have. Once you identify what your expenses are, you take a look at what the tax burden is on them, and you begin to see if there's a way that you can perhaps reduce it. Usually tax rates are tied to consumption, as in the case of, say, electricity. So one way to start there is to go to your meter, same time, every day, and document what the current reading is. Eventually you'll figure out what your current or your average kilowatt hour consumption is and how that ties to the tax dollars you pay. If you figure out a way to reduce that consumption, and this is something that could tie in with that going green you were talking about earlier, you're actually reducing the amount of money you're paying out of pocket, not just to the government in the form of taxes, but also the amount of money that's going to these utility companies. Granted, they're not essentially the target of going Galt, but anything that puts more money in your pocket is going to be a good thing.
Right. Now, I read some of your posts in the Going Galt thread. You were talking about how you cut out all your TV and satellite. You don't even have cable TV or satellite?
That's correct. We don't pay for any television. We only recently just bought a $4 bow tie UHF antenna solely so that we could watch the Super Bowl on CBS. Everything else is done on Hulu or on other online sources. You're going to get the same amount of commercial breaks watching it there, but the thing we really like about it is it's 1 30-second commercial as opposed to 3 or 4 minute commercial breaks.
Right, and then you're not paying the cable taxes, you're not paying the satellite taxes.
I don't have the service, so I'm not paying taxes on it.
I love it. I love this idea of going Galt. And now, we all know that it comes from Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged. But
right.
For those that haven't wanted to wade through the 1,000-plus pages of the book, can you explain who John Galt is and what his role was?
John Galt was essentially, to the best of my recollection, it has been a while since I've read the book, I apologize for that, someone who basically at the start of the book was more of a myth than man, and towards the end we eventually realized was an actual person. Someone who said that he will stop the engine of the world by creating what might become called a reverse strike. In fact, I believe Strike was the original name for Ayn Rand's book over Atlas Shrugged.
Oh.
The idea being simply you have governments, institutions who are taking away money from the producers, those who create wealth. And instead what you have is a situation where John goes around and he convinces them to shut down their companies. And if the companies aren't there, if they're not producing the money, there's no money to feed the beast. So it's not a sense of workers going on strike, leaving the business unable to produce. It's the businesses going on strike, leaving the workers unable to work.
Oh, okay. Okay, so once the workers can't work, then the beast can no longer suck suck from the producers and give to the non-producers, right?
Correct.
Okay, now, one person at the beginning of the thread said, you know, I can see what you're saying, but, you know, we get, even if we get 10,000 of us to quote-unquote Golgolt, we're not going to make a dent in the overall picture. But you responded with a really good post, and if you can just kind of go over that this isn't necessarily to overthrow the system. We're not trying to change the system, but it's almost more of an individual thing.
Right. I don't have the post in front of me right now, but if I recall it correctly, it's essentially, this is not an effort about changing the national scene. This is not about changing the tax law. This is not about having really any kind of grassroots influence. If enough people start doing it, it eventually will happen on its own. But that's not the goal. The goal is plain and simple, you reducing the amount of money you spend so that you have more money available for yourself.
Right. And the more money that you, the less money you spend on taxes, the more money you have to feed your family, the more money you have to take care of the things you need to take care of in your life. And I absolutely love that concept. So what we're going to do each week here on Going Galt is we're going to explore the different ways and the different ideas that people can just simple things they can do in their life to help them go Galt. Like next week, I'd really want to bring up the thing about the limited liability corporation. That's something I'm very interested in myself and trying to put together, and I really want to talk about that. And for all our listeners, check out the thread in the team. If you're not a team member, go to the Radio Free ARFCOM sub-forum. There's a Going Galt thread in there. You can check that out as well. If you have any questions for Matt, feel free to ask him, and he'll get back to you and answer any of your questions about Going Galt. I love this concept, and I think it's something we can really build and grow on, Matt.
Okay.
So you'll be with us every week from now on live, is that right?
I would like to, but life happens and I may have to submit pre-recorded segments.
Sure, not a problem. Not a problem at all. That was Matt Hoffman with Going Galt. Please check out, if you're a team member, check out the Going Galt thread in the team forum. That's all the time we have for today. I want to apologize to Colt Gunner and Hardshell. I've got your Get to Know interviews recorded, and I will put them on next week. I ran long today, and it's my fault. I apologize for that, but don't worry, guys. We are going to get you on. I promise you will both be on next week's show. That's all the time we have for today, ladies and gentlemen. Check us out on our Facebook site. Become a friend with us. Spend some time on AR15.com. It is a great website for firearms owners. I know most of you are already there. We do have a few listeners that do come in from other websites. Make sure you check it out. And we'll see you next week on Radio Free ARFCOM.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.